We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 13. The Hansa Avatar answers questions. We'll start with verse 1, and we'll go to verse 21, and we may go further. And today we will certainly finish the chapter. So, verse 1. Shri Bhagavan Vacha Suttam Rajastama Iti Guna Bhupena Chatmana Satve Nanyatama Hanya Suttam Satina Chevihi. Translation. Supreme Personality of Godhead said, the three modes of material nature, namely goodness, passion, and ignorance, pertain to material intelligence and not to the spirit soul. By development of material goodness, one can conquer the modes of passion and ignorance. And by cultivation of transcendental goodness, one may free oneself even from material goodness. Mukam karoti vachalam bhangam langate yaki pantalam mande shi guru yuritalam om jnana timaram nasya jnanam jalashalakaya chakshunilitam yena tasme shi guru. What do you remember from the last class, chapter 12? Adipush? That's what you remember. Krishna cannot exist if he doesn't remember the gopis. Very good. Yes?
So how Krishna can find his feeling and relationship to the gopis?
Right.
But finally, he could not take any longer his
He finally could not contain his emotions, his feelings for the gopis, and he had to speak. Yes? Brahmana constructs his character. Oh, that's a good one to remember.
Brahmana what?
Brahmana constructs his character. He does not... Oh, you must have missed that. Yeah, he does not go to build a big house, but he constructs his character. Yes.
Lord Krishna sees the gopis as more elevated than himself.
Why? How? Who can say why? Why does Lord Krishna see the gopis more elevated than he himself? Well, one reason, they gave up everything, yes? Same, yeah, they gave up everything. What did Krishna give up? You know, he just enjoys and goes away, and then he enjoys in Dwarka. Of course, at night he's suffering, he's in separation. Actually, we know. We know he's not simply enjoying, yes?
Different
people got different, even demons and rakshasas, they got association from devotees, and they all became devotees. That's very encouraging for us. Yes?
Krishna says, Though I accept you as you are, you don't need to perform any other.
Krishna says to?
Uddhava.
I accept you as you are. Isn't that wonderful? Well, if Krishna would say that to us, it would be a lot easier. Huh? Oh, we have to work. Yes. Right, we don't give up the secondary principles. We do follow them. Okay, yes? We use the knowledge as a means, but once we develop love for Krishna, then it gets in the way. Yes, we lose the knowledge as long as we're not liberated, as long as we're not Krishna conscious, then we need to use it. I mean, it's helpful. Not we need, bhakti is the only need, but it's helpful. These things are helpful. Yes. If you have any problems, go to Balaram. Yes, we have experience. Yes?
Uddhava, go see that bhakti is the highest.
Yeah, bhakti is the highest. And actually, sound is our... By sound, the creation is coming, and by sound, we are liberated.
So he's not discouraging all the other practitioners on the other
right,
levels.
Right.
But he, at the same time, to those who have bhakti, he reveals that he is the highest.
Yes, and all the way through Uddhava Gita, we'll be hearing so much about karma and jnana and everything just to pick these people up who are on that level. But in between there, you'll always find that pure devotional service is actually the best. And all of these lead to pure devotional service. Okay, yes? Yeah, okay. Right. Right, it's for everyone. The knowledge is for everyone.
But you are my pure devotee, so you may need to follow all
Yeah, no need.
don't worry about it, Uddhava. You're okay as you are. Yes, you don't worry about all these different. It's for everyone and not just for you. You don't just imagine if your guru said, okay, you have to do karma, you have to do gyan, and you have to do yoga, ashtanga, and then bhakti. All together. You'd be confused. You would be confused.
And then
forget everything and just do bhakti. Ooh. Yes. Okay. Yes, you're also confused, like Uddhava, okay? Oh, so what is your question? I didn't quite catch. Oh, why was he confused? Yeah, he heard Braja Bhakti. But the confusion is this, that, okay, this is the highest, but how do I get there? How do I develop this love? Okay, I can't, you know. Do I go and milk the cows and you know, okay, so now we know the gopis is the highest. So what do we do? Go out and live in the village and make cow patties and, you know, there has to be a process. Yes?
Chandu Maharaj sometimes said that a teacher is often endeavors to create a confusion.
The teacher, okay. So that was his question. Did Krishna do it on purpose?
Because this confusion leads to a sincere inquiry, and inquiry is the wealth of a question which leads to answers.
Yes, and we'll hear about Parokshavada. I'm not sure if it's in this class, because I studied two chapters yesterday, 21 and this one. But is it in this purport, Parokshavada? Okay, maybe it's in 21. That Parokshavada means that Krishna is very happy to hear truth that is spoken indirectly. Indirect truth is very pleasing. So he also does the same too. You ask a question and you don't get the answer you're expecting. You know, you're expecting, okay, this is the answer, you know, but actually you get something indirect, so it has to really make you think. You know, and this chapter today is like that. That Krishna, the Hans avatar, is going to make them think. You know, they'll ask a simple question, who are you? And then he just starts the whole philosophy, you know, with, what kind of question are you asking me? You know? So it's like, it's a test. It's a test also, testing the disciple and testing the people who are asking the questions. The test is there. So, that we'll see. Yes, probably in chapter 21, but it's interesting. These chapters very much follow each other. They're parallel. I studied them together just by chance, but they're very parallel chapters. Okay, so we'll go on to today's class about the three modes of nature. It starts with the three modes, and then how goodness is best, and you can conquer passion and ignorance by goodness, but higher than goodness is transcendental goodness. Yes, I think 21 also deals with a little bit about the modes. Okay, and you can free oneself even from material goodness. So in the purport, as it explained, goodness in the material world never exists in a pure form. Therefore, it is common knowledge that on the material platform, no one is working without personal motivation. So this personal motivation is the influence of passion and ignorance. You want something. It's passion. Passion means you have some desire that you want something in return. So that's why even if you're a good person, even if you're giving in charity, you want something in return. All these rich people in America, they make these foundations and give in charity to escape taxes. So then they don't have to pay all these taxes. You know, if you give it in charity or you have a foundation, but still they manage to keep a lot of money that way. It's not... Even though they look like very good philanthropic people, but actually it's mixed. They do want something back in return. It's not just a pure, like Mother Teresa, going and giving up everything. In the material world, goodness is always mixed with some amount of passion and ignorance, whereas spiritual or purified goodness, Vishuddhisattva, represents the liberated platform of perfection. Materially, one is proud to be an honest, compassionate man. But unless one is fully Krishna conscious, one will speak truths that are not ultimately significant. And when we'll give mercy that is ultimately useless. Who can give me an example of a truth that an honest, compassionate man will speak that is not ultimately significant? What sort of truth do these people speak who are philanthropists and New Age people? Something comes to my mind right now that your mind can do everything. Your mind is the power. You have the power to do everything just by your mind. I mean, so this is one of their truths. Yes, by the mind. Yes.
They also say the people is God.
People are God, yeah.
If you serve people, you serve God.
Yeah, in India they say work is worship. If you do your work, then that is your puja. That is your worship. Work is worship. So this is not a very significant truth because the work will be finished when you leave this body, and the result will be also temporary. You know, whatever good you do, it will be temporary, and the whole thing will be finished. So what is the significance of that truth? It's not an ultimately significant truth. And give mercy that is ultimately useless. Yes, mercy. Because the onward march of material time removes all situations and persons from the material stage. It's very poetic here. Our so-called mercy and truth apply to situations that shortly will not exist. Okay, so that's one point. Real truth is eternal, and real mercy means to situate people in eternal truth. Still, for an ordinary person, cultivation of material goodness may be a preliminary stage on the road to Krishna consciousness, like vegetarianism helps a lot. If you're vegetarian, you can understand spiritual life easier. It makes it easier for you to understand. For example, that's just what it says. It is stated in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, one who is addicted to meat eating cannot understand the pastimes of Lord Krishna. By cultivation of material mode of goodness, however, one may become a vegetarian and perhaps come to appreciate the sublime process of Krishna consciousness. Since it's clearly stated in Bhagavad Gita, the material modes of nature constantly rotate, one must take advantage of an elevated position in material goodness to step onto the transcendental platform. Otherwise, as the wheel of time turns, one will again go into the darkness of material ignorance. So if you don't take up spiritual life, you may be in the mode of goodness, but again, the Ferris wheel goes up and the Ferris wheel comes down. You will go up very high, but then again you will come down. So Vishwanathacharati comments, in this chapter, the Lord speaks of the method of removing material contamination from the heart by meditation on the Lord. In order to become free from the material world, through the story related to Hamsa and Kumaras, we will do some meditation today. We will try to do Sankhya Yoga meditation today, so be prepared. The Lord mentioned destroying samsara by the acts of knowledge. The method of producing knowledge is now described in 7 verses. So these next 7 verses, 2 to 8, will describe a method. The gunas do not belong to the jiva. They belong to the intelligence. The binding gunas of ignorance must be destroyed. The rajas and tamas portions are destroyed by sattva. Sattva with truth and compassion is destroyed by the condition of cessation, or that is Sudha Sattva. So Satyaraj, he comments that, you know, people now in the world, they don't understand the difference between material goodness and transcendental goodness. They don't understand this. Ordinary people, they think goodness is goodness. If I'm honest, if I'm this, they don't see the need for it being spiritual or transcendental. They don't see the need. They say, I'm good. This is good. You know, why you want to bring in God, our spiritual life. So he says generally the line between the two is blurred, with people often confusing one with the other. So he gives nice examples. For example, morals and ethics are often thought of as spiritual. So this is spiritual. If you're honest, if you're clean, if you do the right thing, this is spiritual life. And mundane sectarian religion is seen as transcendental truth. If you go to God and pray for bread, if you go and ask for things from God, then this is the highest thing. But Uddhava Gita teaches something different. No human-centered laws can take us beyond the material world. No religion that has its origin in time or is beleaguered by material concerns can reach the ultimate destination. Real spiritual life centers on love of God, completely transcending the material world. Then he says, actions or dispositions that enhance that love are indicative of transcendental goodness, as opposed to all seemingly wholesome derivatives, which have material betterment as their focus, which is merely material goodness. So he's saying that things that will help us to develop our love for God, this is transcendental. And things which have the goal to become better in the material world, a better person in this world, and that is mundane. That is mundane. So here in this chapter, he's going to tell us about material goodness and about transcending material goodness. So verse 2, when the living entity becomes strongly situated in the mode of goodness, then religious principles characterized by devotional service to me become prominent. One can strengthen the mode of goodness by cultivation of those things that are already situated in goodness, and thus religious principles arise. So this is the benefit of the mode of goodness, that when you're in the mode of goodness, then it's a very fertile ground for religion, for dharma to flourish. Religious principles will flourish when you're in the mode of goodness. And when you have religious principles, then devotional service can also flourish. It's much easier if you get up early, go to sleep early, and, you're up for the Brahma Muhurta time. It's easier. It's just easier to chant. You try chanting if you, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon or 7 o'clock at night, I didn't finish my rounds. Then the whole day you're trying to finish your rounds. But if you finish your rounds, at 7 in the morning, then you're free for the whole day to do whatever you have to do. Otherwise, it's difficult. So it's very helpful to get up before sunrise, to get up Brahma Muhurta hour, be in the mode of goodness. Now, how to strengthen the mode of goodness? Cultivate those things. And we'll hear about what are those things in goodness, what things we should cultivate in goodness a few verses later. And I believe it must be actually in chapter 21, and he goes into detail. But even before chapter 21, it'll be in one of the purports here on the verses. So what it means, these things in goodness. Yes, 21 explains the auspicious time, place, and objects, how they become auspicious. So that in the mode of goodness, what are things in the mode of goodness? It's explained. Okay, since the three modes of material nature are constantly in conflict, vying for supremacy, how is it possible the mode of goodness can subdue the modes of passion and ignorance? Lord Krishna here explains how one can be strongly fixed in a mode of goodness, which automatically gives rise to religious principles. In the 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna elaborately explains the things that are in goodness, passion, and ignorance. Thus, by choosing food, attitudes, work, recreation, etc., strictly in the mode of goodness, one will become situated in that mode. Okay, food, attitudes, work, recreation. The usefulness of sattva guna, or mode of goodness, is that it produces religious principles aimed at and characterized by devotional service to Lord Krishna. Without such devotional service to the Lord, mode of goodness is considered useless and merely another aspect of material illusion. Yeah, so why do we cultivate the mode of goodness? So we can do our service. So we can advance in Krishna consciousness. That's the purpose of cultivating. It's not just so we can enjoy, because the fruits of mode of goodness are knowledge and happiness. We can be very happy. We can get peace by cultivating the mode of goodness. But our purpose is to serve Krishna and to advance in devotional service. So it's very helpful to cultivate the mode of goodness for that reason. Other people, they'll do it for peace and for other things. The word vridhat, or strengthened, increased, indicates clearly one should come to the platform of vishuddha sattva, or purified goodness. The word vridhat indicates growth, and growth should not be stopped until full maturity is reached. The full maturity of goodness is called Vishuddha Sattva, or the transcendental platform on which there is no trace of any other quality. In pure goodness, all knowledge automatically manifests, and one can easily understand one's eternal loving relationship with Lord Krishna. That is the actual meaning and purpose of Dharma, or religious principles. Shira Madhvacharya points out in this regard, an increase in the mode of goodness strengthens religious principles, and the invigorated execution of religious principles strengthens the mode of goodness. So they both nourish each other. If you're in the mode of goodness, then you will be very strong in practicing religious principles. And if you practice nicely, this will help you become in the mode of goodness. So they go together. And that way one can advance higher and higher in the mode of spiritual happiness. Verse 3. Religious principles, strengthened by the mode of goodness, destroy the influence of passion and ignorance. So this is the explanation of how it works. How do you get rid of passion and ignorance? By cultivating the mode of goodness, which produces strengthened, strong religious principles. Then you can get rid of passion and ignorance. When passion and ignorance are overcome, their original cause, irreligion, is quickly vanquished. 4. Now we're going to hear about what things we have to cultivate in goodness. According to the quality of religious scriptures, so we need scriptures in goodness, water in goodness, one's association with one's children or with people in general in goodness. The particular place should be in goodness. The time, activities, birth, meditation, chanting of mantras and purificatory rituals, the modes of nature become differently prominent. An interesting thing to note is birth here does not mean the birth of the body. You can cultivate birth in the mode of goodness. How can you do that? Yes, Kalpit.
Initiation.
Very good. Yes, initiation. That's birth. That's our real birth. So we have to cultivate birth in the mode of goodness by getting initiated. That's initiation. Purport. The 10 items mentioned above possess superior and inferior qualities and are thus identified as being in goodness, passion, or ignorance. One can increase the mode of goodness by selecting religious scriptures in goodness, pure water, friendship with other persons in goodness, and so on. One should scrupulously avoid any of these 10 items that may be polluted by an inferior mode of nature. 5. Among the 10 items I have just mentioned, the great sages who understand Vedic knowledge have praised and recommended those that are in the mode of goodness, criticized and rejected those in the mode of ignorance, and shown indifference to those in the mode of passion. Interesting. How do the sages react to the modes? So in goodness, they praise and recommend. Ignorance, they criticize and reject. But passion, they're indifferent. So, if you want to be a sage, then this is what you have to, this is your attitude here to the modes of nature. 6. Until one revives one's direct knowledge of the spirit soul and drives away the illusory identification with the material body and mind caused by the 3 modes of nature, one must cultivate those things in the mode of goodness. So until you understand your spirit soul, eternal servant of Krishna, the only way you can drive it away is if you know your relationship with Krishna. By increasing the mode of goodness, one automatically can understand and practice religious principles, and by such practice, transcendental knowledge is awakened. So until we're liberated, we must cultivate the mode of goodness, and even after we're liberated, we'll like the mode of goodness as well. Even after you're liberated, you'll reject ignorance, and you will be indifferent to passion. Okay, now, close your books right now. Don't look at your book and your computer. Don't look at your computer. So, the purport we will ask you. What are religious scriptures, and what do religious scriptures in the mode of goodness teach? So this he's explaining in the purport. What are religious scriptures in the mode of goodness? What do they teach? Yes?
Devotional service.
Devotional service. Yes. Well, very good. That should be the answer to every question. But here it says. Yeah. Okay, here it says, well, we're in the mode of goodness now. We're not transcendental yet. Detachment from mental speculation and material sense gratification. So this is scripture in the mode of goodness. May not be even devotional service. They're just teaching detachment from jnana and karma. So, okay. They don't... Not scriptures that provide rituals and mantras to increase material ignorance. So we have such scriptures. Such materialistic activities do not give attention to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and are basically atheistic. Now, don't look again. Keep your books closed. Oh, water? Okay, we know. Pure water is good. Now, what don't we need besides water? There's so many things he's listing. Yeah?
Liquor,
okay?
Fragrances.
Perfume, beer, whiskey, all these things. They are polluted manifestations of water. We don't need them. They are not in the mode of goodness. Pure water only is in the mode of goodness. Okay, next. Milk is okay, yeah, of course. That is very nice. We're talking about water. Okay, who should you associate with? Now, we're in the mode of goodness here. We're not actually devotees. Yes?
Those in the mode of goodness.
Those in the mode of goodness, yeah. Yeah, that was, yeah, how you associate with it. It says, but in the prayer part it doesn't talk about that. Okay, anybody else have an idea? Yeah?
People who are religious and knowledgeable.
Religious and knowledgeable, very good. But detachment is again here.
Detachment.
And who are not materially, you shouldn't associate with those who are sinful. Or materially attached. Hey, you opened your book. Okay. I'm watching now. Okay. Where should you live?
Solitary
place where there are devotees. Don't be attracted to busy highway shopping centers, malls, sports stadiums. This is, you know, people in the West, they actually are attracted. Devotees in the West. Okay, time. In the mode of goodness, yes.
Brahma Muhurt,
very good. Yeah, very good. That time you should get up. Avoid midnight when ghosts and demons are encouraged to become active. Yeah, and there was one paper I got in Mayapur, I forget who it's from, and it was explaining that the more sleep you get before midnight, then the more rested you'll be. And especially there's 1 hour between 11 and 12 usually that your pineal gland up here your brain needs that time to replenish your brain. So it's really important to sleep early and you'll feel rested.
Time.
I don't know. You ask him, don't you? Why are you asking me? I never heard of midnight arti, but one thing is in Scandinavia, you know, the sun doesn't go down in the summer. So the sun doesn't go down in Scandinavia. So I don't know. Anyway, whatever, you ask him. I never heard it. Prabhupada didn't give us that. He said Krishna needs to rest because he's herding the cows the whole day. Midnight arti. Okay. Well, that you have to ask him about that. Rasadans, right. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Prabhupada said that Krishna needs to sleep. So we follow that. In New York, they were getting Krishna up early at 3:30 so the Sankirtan devotees could go out early to sell books. And Prabhupada looked at the deities. He said, Krishna is not getting enough sleep. You should not wake him up so early. He's tending the cows every day somewhere in New York. I don't know where, but that was New York Temple. And he needs his rest. So, yes, then you have to ask Maharshi about that. Maybe he got some instruction from Prabhupada. Okay, birth in the mode of goodness. We talked about that. Second birth of initiation, learn to chant Hare Krishna. One should not accept initiation in unauthorized mystical or religious cults in the modes of passion and ignorance. One should meditate on the Lord as the enjoyer of all sacrifice and in the lives of great devotees and saintly person. Mantras. That's an easy one. Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. We should follow the example of Lord Chaitanya. No other songs, verses, poetry, or mantras that glorify the kingdom of illusion. Rituals in the mode of goodness. What should be the purpose of rituals? Purification, very good. Purify the soul, not to bring material blessings on one's material household. So people perform many different kinds of rituals. Okay, so now we can go back to the purport. Second paragraph. One who increases the mode of goodness will certainly become fixed in religious principles, and automatically knowledge will arise. As knowledge increases, one is able to understand the eternal spirit, soul, and supreme soul, Lord Krishna. Thus the soul becomes free from the artificial imposition of the gross and subtle material bodies caused by the modes of material nature. Spiritual knowledge burns to ashes the material designations that cover the living entity, and one's real eternal life begins. When will that day come? Verse 7. Now we have a nice analogy. Fire is coming back here. Remember about our guru, fire, one of our 24 gurus? Fire is doing what? Huh? Purification. And? Yes, burning to ashes all sins. Okay. So let's see what fire is going to do now. In a bamboo forest, the wind sometimes rubs, it's wind also here, the bamboo stalks together, and such friction generates a blazing fire that consumes the very source of its birth, the bamboo forest. Thus, the fire is automatically calmed by its own action. Similarly, by the competition and interaction of the material modes of nature, the subtle and gross material bodies are generated. If one uses his mind and body to cultivate knowledge, then such enlightenment destroys the influence of the modes of nature that generated one's body. Thus, like the fire, the body and mind are pacified by their own actions in destroying the source of their birth. Interesting. So, by association with the modes, passion, goodness, passion, ignorance, we got our body and mind. So Prabhupada said it's like a disease. We become infected by a disease, and the disease is the modes. And because of that, then the result is we got a material mind and a material body. So how to cure the disease? Here the verse is saying, if you want to cure your disease of attachment to the modes, then cultivate knowledge. Use your mind and body to cultivate knowledge. And then if you use your mind and body in that way, then the disease will be burnt up. It will be all cured, like the fire. And then the body and mind will be pacified, destroying the source of their birth. The source of their birth is the modes.
Interaction
of the modes, right. Purport, the word guna vyataya ja is significant in this verse. Vyataya indicates change or inversion in the normal order of things. Sri Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur has described the concept of vyatyaya by giving the Sanskrit synonym vaishamya, which indicates inequality or disproportionate diversity. Everybody understand that? Inequality. Thus it is understood by the term guna vyataya ja, the body is generated by the unstable relationships of the three modes of material nature, which exist everywhere in constantly changing proportions. So we also hear that the origin of creation is sound. From sound then comes the gross elements, like one by one, the wind, the sky, the air, and everything goes down like that. So by sound also our body and everything has become created. Now we want to reverse anavriti shabda. By sound also we can reverse that, to go back to Godhead. So by chanting Hare Krishna, then we're reversing the creation going back to the modes and finishing the modes of nature. We go back to the root of the disease by chanting the holy name, and then it burns up all of our bodily and mental attachment, and then we're situated on the transcendental level of goodness. So that's our, what is he saying? It's been created and now we have to reverse it. We have to go back. So how do we do that? How do we reverse this creation of the body as we chant? And that sound has the potency to bring us into existence, has the potency to bring us out also, to liberate us. Anavriti Shabdat, it says, Vedanta Sutra. So now from verse 8 into 11, we'll hear about the bondage of the modes by Sri Uddhava. My dear Krishna, generally human beings know that material life brings great future unhappiness. Still, they try to enjoy material life. My dear Lord, how can one be in knowledge? How can one in knowledge act just like a dog, an ass, or a goat? The problem is they're not in knowledge. Most of them. But sometimes a person is in knowledge. Well, they have some sort of knowledge. They know it's miserable. They know it's miserable. So why do they continue to act? That's his question. Even though people know the result is going to be suffering, why do they still continue? What, yes?
They have no option.
Huh?
They have no option.
They have no option, yeah, that's how they think. They say, well, what else can we do? This is our life, this is life. Life means problem. Yes?
They have no higher taste.
They have no higher taste, right.
Conditioning.
Conditioning.
Conditioning is difficult to break out of.
Yeah, even for devotees. Conditioning is very difficult to break out of. Yes?
Due to our false pride, we cannot accept that we are committing
errors. Yeah. Right.
They will not allow us to accept it.
Right. They can't accept that they're wrong.
Yeah.
They're going the wrong path. Yeah?
Their knowledge is theoretical and their heart is still in the grip of passion.
Knowledge is theoretical. Theoretically, they know. They haven't experienced that it's suffering and their heart is still in the grip of passion. That's the main point. They're gripped in passion. And so even they know they're going to suffer, even they know, they still go on and do it. Okay. Purport. The standard methods of enjoyment in the material world are sex, money, and false prestige, all of which are obtained with great suffering and eventually lost. One engaged in material life suffers in the present, has only a very bleak future to look forward to in the continuing cycle of birth and death. Thus, how can human beings who have seen these things and know them very well continue to enjoy life like dogs, asses, and goats? Often the dog will approach a bitch for sex, but the lady dog may not be attracted and will show her teeth, snarl, and threaten the poor dog with serious injury. Still, he goes about his business trying to get a little sex pleasure. Similarly, many times a dog risks being beaten or shot while stealing some food in a place where he knows he should not go. The ass is very attracted to the she-ass, but the lady ass often kicks him in the legs. Similarly, the ass's master gives the ass a handful of grass, which the poor ass could get anywhere and then burdens him with great loads. The goat is generally raised for slaughter, and even when the goat is brought into the slaughterhouse, he shamelessly goes after the lady goat to get sex pleasure. In this way, even at the risk of being shot, bitten, beaten, and slaughtered, animals persist in their foolish sense gratification. How can an educated human being commit himself to such a condemned way of life, wherein the result is practically the same as that of the animals? If, by cultivating the mode of goodness, one's life is filled with happiness, enlightenment, and future rewards, why would anyone cultivate the modes of passion and ignorance? This is Uddhava's question. Because Uddhava's in the mode of goodness, obviously. You know, he'll say, what is the need? Why should we go, you know, why do people do this? He doesn't understand. He doesn't know. So verse 9:10, Supreme Personality of Godhead said, my dear Uddhava, a person bereft of intelligence first falsely identifies himself with the material body and mind, and when such false knowledge arises within one's consciousness, material passion, the cause of great suffering, pervades the mind. So first you think, okay, I'm this body, I'm this mind, then passion. So material passion pervades the mind, which by nature is situated in goodness. Then the mind, contaminated by passion, becomes absorbed in making and changing many plans for material advancement. Thus, by constantly thinking of the modes of material nature, a foolish person is afflicted with unbearable material desires. So that's how it happens. It all starts with false ego, that we are thinking, I am the mind, I am the body. So we'll go to paragraph 2, second line. The words sankalpa savikalpaka indicate a materialist is always making new plans or modifying his old plans to increase his material enjoyment, although in his saner moments he admits that material life is full of suffering. But most of them won't admit. They won't admit. They will say, no, I'm happy. What do you mean? What suffering? The mind is created from the mode of goodness, as described in Sankhya philosophy. And the natural, peaceful situation of the mind is pure love of Krishna, in which there is no mental disturbance, disappointment, or confusion. Artificially, the mind is dragged down to a lower platform in passion or ignorance, and thus one is never satisfied. Okay, so yes, as you say, he's gripped in passion and then he's dragged down. Verse 11, one who does not control the material senses comes under the control of material desires and is thus bewildered by the strong waves of the mode of passion. Such a person executes material activities, although clearly seeing the result will be future unhappiness. So now we're going to hear some more verses from verse 12. And these verses are going to show how an intelligent person recognizes how the modes are influencing his intelligence, and he becomes detached. So we're going to hear now how we should use our intelligence to get free from the modes. Verse 12. Although the intelligence of a learned person may be bewildered by the modes of passion and ignorance, he should again carefully bring the mind under control. By clearly seeing the contamination of the modes of nature, he does not become attached. So this is the process of knowledge. In the process of knowledge, intelligence is prominent. You use your intelligence. You use your intelligence to, when something is happening to you, when you fall, you may fall into passion, you may fall into ignorance, and then you use your intelligence to say, no, this is the mode of passion. This is not me. Remember, where is the mode of passion and ignorance? Where do you find them? Intelligence. Okay. They're in the intelligence. The passion and ignorance. So therefore, the intelligence has to be very careful, alert. By clearly seeing contamination of the modes, he does not become attached. So the modes are coming, and your mind is saying, yes, this is for me, not for Krishna. Forget about Krishna. This is for me. And so then the intelligence says, no, this is passion. You should not do this. So your intelligence brings you back. Why are you making more misery for yourself? You know what will happen. The mode of passion brings misery. So don't do it. And ignorance brings greed and more misery, more suffering, madness. So you have to use your intelligence. This is the yoga process. This is the process of Gyan. A person should be, verse 13, a person should be attentive and grave and never lazy or morose. So this is yoga. You're very attentive. What are you attentive about in yoga? What are you very alert and attentive about? Yeah, the mind. What's the mind doing? Where is the mind going? That is where your attention is in the yoga process. Very attentive, very grave. Don't let the mind make you frivolous. Never lazy. So this is how to use your intelligence. Don't think, okay, today is a good day and I'm really on top of things today. And you'll see in a few, probably very soon, that you're not on top of things. Krishna will test you, or the material energy will say, okay, now you are lazy, let me come. Let me come and take you. Are morose, depressed. Now, if you're depressed also, that will bring you down. So two positive qualities you should have, your intelligence, when you're in dealing with the mind. Attentive, be grave, don't be lazy, and don't be morose. If you're too depressed, then you'll think, it's hopeless, I can't do anything. I'll just flow with it. It's just too much. That's also lazy. I'll just flow with it and let my mind. I can listen. I'm chanting very nicely and I'm doing so much service. But this time, I'll let my mind be happy, and my body, and I will follow them. So don't be lazy. Don't be morose. Be attentive. Mastering the yoga procedures of breathing and sitting properly. Once you practice fixing the mind on me at dawn, noon, and sunset. And thus, gradually the mind should be completely absorbed in me. So this is Gayatri Mantra, chanted by Brahmins at dawn, noon, and sunset. And if you don't have Gayatri, then you can chant Hare Krishna, Maha Mantra, dawn, noon, and sunset. It's no problem. Verse 14, the actual yoga system is taught by my devotees, headed by Sanat Kumara, is simply this. Having withdrawn the mind from all other objects, one should directly and appropriately absorb it in me. So here's a one-sentence summary of the yoga system. Always think of Krishna. Think of me. Withdraw it from everything else. So, Satyaraj. And this Prabhupada also said this many times. Pranayama, asana, meditation are meant for one thing alone, to gain mastery over the senses, which were meant to focus on the Supreme Lord. So Prabhupada would quote Indriya Samyama, something Indriya Samyama, there is another word before that, that you are controlling your senses for a purpose, and that is to fix the mind on Krishna. Everything we're doing has a purpose. So this Jnana Yoga, Krishna is showing what is the purpose of yoga. That is to, you control your senses, you do your breathing, you do everything, so you can fix your mind on me. So a comment by Jiva Goswami. If a person has a pure heart, engages in devotional service, devotional activities that begin with surrender, does not abandon the process of chanting the Lord's holy name, he'll find himself engaged in smaranam, meditation, which is mind, with his mind fixed on the Supreme Lord. Meditation has many forms, beginning with meditation on of the Lord's holy names. So this is described, meditation, in this verse. And it is also given to us by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Which verse is that? Meditate on me. Think of me. Manmanava from Abhakto. Very good. Madhyaji mam namaskaru. Always think of me. It's one of the most important verses in Bhagavad Gita, giving instruction by Krishna. Last two, 65 and 66. Sri Uddhava said, my dear Keshava, at what time and in what form did you instruct the science of yoga to Sanaka and his brothers? I now desire to know about these things. So he mentioned Sanaka in one verse. Which verse was that? Somewhere back there he said, I taught this to Sanaka, but I don't see where. Anyway. Now he's asking, okay, when did you tell them this knowledge? And now we're good. And once we find out when he did this, we're going to find out how, you know, what that knowledge was in a much more detailed way. Verse 16, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, once the mental sons of Lord Brahma, the sages headed by Sanaka, inquired from their father about the difficult subject matter of the supreme goal of yoga. 17, the sages headed by Sanaka said, O Lord, people's minds are naturally attracted to material sense objects, and similarly, the sense objects in the form of desire enter within the mind. Therefore, how can a person who desires liberation, who desires to cross over activities of sense gratification, destroy this mutual relationship between the sense objects and the mind? Please explain this to me. So Vishwanath explains how. He says, consciousness enters into sense objects because of natural attraction, and the objects enter into the consciousness. So you see that. If your mind is attracted to something, if you see something that you want to enjoy, then immediately it goes in your mind. That thing goes in your mind. You look at something, and then it might even come back the next day, and the next day, oh, yes, I saw a pineapple, and I really want to have pineapple, and you'll just keep thinking about it, and then eventually you'll just get a pineapple or whatever. And so it goes in your mind. You say, yes, oh, that would be nice for me. So let me have that. And so how to separate the objects, sense objects, from the mind? Verse 18, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, my dear Uddhava, Brahma himself, who is born directly from the body of the Lord and who is the creator of all living entities within the material world, being the best of the demigods, seriously contemplated the question of his sons headed by Sanaka. The intelligence of Brahma, however, was affected by his own activities of creation, and thus he could not discover the essential answer to this question. He was attached to his creation, and his creation was going in his consciousness. So he couldn't separate it from his consciousness. So how could he give the answer. Now, Srila Jiva Goswami in purport has quoted three verses from second canto of Bhagavatam as follows. In the ninth chapter, verse 32, Lord Krishna blessed Brahma with realized knowledge of the Lord's actual form, qualities, and activities. So that was before he spoke the Chatushloki. So how is it possible he could be bewildered? In the ninth chapter, verse 37, that's after the Chatushloki, the Lord ordered Brahma to rigidly carry out the Lord's injunctions and affirm that Brahma would thus never be bewildered in his cosmic decision-making. But he did get bewildered again. In the sixth chapter, verse 34, Lord Brahma assured his son Narada, O Narada, because I've caught hold of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, with great zeal, whatever I say has never proved to have been false, nor is the progress of my mind ever deterred, nor are my senses ever degraded by temporary attachment to matter. So why did he become bewildered? He got two assurances from the Lord, and he also said to Narada, I never have a problem with my mind. My mind is never stopped. So in this verse of the 13th chapter of 11th canto, Lord Krishna states, Brahma unfortunately did become bewildered by his creative functions, thus providing a grave lesson to all of the Lord's empowered representatives. Although one may be elevated to an exalted position in the Lord's transcendental service, at any moment there is a danger of false pride polluting one's devotional mentality. So this is a warning to us. Brahma couldn't get the answer. You might think, I know the answer, right? Well, okay, if that's your pride, then your pride is there, then you'll fall down. Then you're thinking you're better than Brahma. Or you're thinking you're better than Prabhupada, you're thinking, anyway. So devotees sometimes become like that. They learn Sanskrit and they think, I know I can translate better than Prabhupada did. And so this is the pride. Remember in the third canto, ninth chapter, Lord Brahma was praying for protection from fall down due to two things. Remember that? What was that? Remember those two?
Pride and laziness or inactivity, indolence or something.
No, not that. It was another thing. Two things that are problems of devotees that we see. If you look at the history of our movement, why devotees fall down. One is pride. Pride may be everything, yes?
The other is the anarthas which come along with...
Yeah, that's a general...
Rewards.
But Lord Brahma, yeah?
Offense.
Okay, this is what Lord Brahma prayed for. Pride and deviation. See, devotees, they can deviate and start their own movement. This is what we see in our history of ISKCON. Deviation, right? This is what Brahma prayed for protection from. Pride and deviation. So this is a lesson for us. And here it happened to him. He got bewildered. So if you become bewildered, then you'll know why. Pride. Actually, here it's pride. I am a great preacher. I know all the answers, and everybody should worship me. And that is the pride of the preacher. And why don't they? Okay, Lord Brahma, verse 19, desired to attain the answer to the question that was puzzling him, and thus he fixed his mind on me, the Supreme Lord. At that time, in my form of Hamsa, I became visible to Lord Brahma. Purport. So at least Brahma knew what to do. When you get bewildered, then you should think of Krishna, or your spiritual master, or Balaram, or somebody to help you. So when Brahma became bewildered, he fixed his mind on the Lord, and he appeared in the form of Hamsa. Purport. Hamsa means swan. And the specific ability of the swan is to separate a mixture of milk and water, extracting the rich, milky portion. Similarly, Lord Krishna appeared as Hamsa, or the swan, in order to separate the pure consciousness of Lord Brahma from the modes of material nature. So it's very significant that he appeared as swan, because Lord Brahma has his pure spiritual life, but right now it was a little bit muddy, mixed, and so the Lord came to deliver, to take out the spiritual part and leave aside the muddy part. 20. Thus seeing me, the sages, placing Brahma in the lead, came forward and worship my lotus feet. Then they frankly asked me, "Who are you?" 21. My dear Uddhava, the sages, being eager to understand the ultimate truth of the yoga system, thus inquired from me. Now, please hear as I explain that which I spoke unto the sages. So that question is very interesting. Who are you? Here it says the purpose of their asking that question is to understand the truth of the yoga system. So it's an interesting question to ask, you know. Why didn't they just say, "Well, can you explain the yoga system to us, please?" No, instead they said, "Who are you?" And he is also not going to, and he's going to answer with the yoga system. So he understood the question, actually. And this is indirect. This is parokshavad, that they're asking. Perhaps they were asking indirectly, and so he took it. He took the essence of the question. He took why they're asking the question. He didn't say, "No, okay." Say, well, we'll see what he said anyway. Let's read verse 22. My dear Brahmanas, if, when asking me who I am, you believe that I am also a jiva soul, and there is no ultimate difference between us, since all souls are ultimately one without individuality, then how is your question possible or appropriate? Ultimately, what is the real situation or resting place both of yourselves and of me? So if I'm just one of you, then what's the use of your question? And if I'm just one of you, what's the use of the answer? So he's just starting out like that. And he understood their, and he was seeing the mistake in their question too, the flaw in the question, "Who are you?" So he's picking apart the question. So we'll go to the last paragraph of the purport. Now, Krishna's actual purpose is to explain the ultimate perfection of yoga. So that's what they wanted to know, which the sages were desiring to know. If one becomes fixed in transcendental knowledge, the mutual attraction between the material mind and material sense objects automatically ceases. So what was the analogy that we heard, how this happens with knowledge? We just, bamboo, if a wind blows the bamboo in the forest, automatically friction comes, and then fire, and everything, and then it burns up the source of their birth. So knowledge, when we get knowledge, our mind and our body will become all burnt up. And material sense objects, here it says, if one becomes fixed in transcendental knowledge, the mutual attraction between the material mind and material sense objects automatically ceases. So we'll all be burnt up in the fire of knowledge. What are some verses in Bhagavad Gita? There is a verse. Arjuna, is it? Te Arjuna. Then? Yeah, anyway. Yeah, as the fire burns wood to ashes, so the fire of knowledge burns.
The worst sins.
What?
The worst sins.
The worst sins. Okay. The worst sins. Sins, okay. The worst sins are burned to ashes by the fire of knowledge. There's also the boat of knowledge, even if you're the most sinful of sinners. That's chapter 4, verse 37. Yes, the fire of knowledge burns up your sins. Okay, so here it says, the spiritual mind is not attracted to material objects of gratification. And thus, by spiritualizing the mind, material existence automatically slackens. So if your mind becomes spiritual, then you won't be attracted to the sense objects. Even if you become older, it helps also a lot. You can't eat, your diet gets very restricted, and then you start not even desiring those things that are bad for you. Usually the things that are bad for you are the ones you want to eat the most. But after a while, then if you spiritualize your senses, then you understand, no, actually, these very natural, simple foods are the best. By questioning propriety of the sage's question, the Lord is assuming position of the spiritual master and preparing to give valuable instructions. One should never be envious of a bona fide spiritual master, especially if, as in the case of Lord Hamsa, speaking to the sages headed by Brahma and Sanakumara, the Guru is the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. So Vishwanath goes through this verse and the next verse and the next verse. He says, in asking, who are you, do you think I'm a jiva? So that's this verse. Or, do you think I'm a material body? So that's the next verse. Or, do you think I'm the Supreme Lord? A few verses later. First, Hamsa dismisses the idea that he is a jiva. So, yes, Satyaraj says, Krishna is speaking Mayavad philosophy. It's all one. If you think we're all one, then what's the use of your question? Krishna wants the sages to deeply think about this and how it falls short. He also wants them to contemplate their ultimate destination as well as his, for in so doing they'll realize that they in the end must submit to him, not he to them. So he's establishing his position as spiritual master in this reply. And this is also very indirect, parokshavada, indirect speaking. He's not speaking directly. The question of destination also clarifies the question of individuality, showing Krishna is a supreme individual and the sages are subservient to him. Because in his answer, he's saying a question. His answer is a question. Instead of an answer, he gives a question. Ultimately, what is the real situation or resting place of yourselves and of me? So he asks two questions. How is your question appropriate or possible, and what is the real resting place of you and me? So that's his response, two questions. That is his first response to their question, who are you? Now, if you said that to somebody, they'll think you're really crazy. If somebody asks, who are you? And you say, well, if you think I'm jiva like you, then they'll think, anyway, they'll think you're a little bit strange. So we'll go to one more verse and then we'll stop. Verse 23. If by asking me, who are you, you're referring to the material body. Because most people, when they ask, who are you, are referring to the material body. Who are you? Yeah, okay, I'm such and such. This is my name. This is my address. This is what I do. Not what I do, what my body does. Yes, because if you do nothing, then they'll say, that won't be a definition of who are you. Or it could be, I guess. Could be, but usually they want to know, what is your job? What is your service? Are you married? Do you have a family? So this is referring to your body. They don't ask you, nobody asks, who are you, in reference to your mind. They just ask you in reference to your body. I mean, do you know anybody? You knew somebody who asked that question? Who are you? Yeah, Indians. Oh, yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Where is your husband? Where is your children? Son, you have a son and daughter. You have. And where is he? Where is your house?
Which country are you from?
Yeah, huh? Which? Yeah, that's the first one. First question: which country are you from? Yes. And for the women, it's: are you married? I have more different questions. But anyway, they're asking about the body. Nobody's asking, who are you, mentally. So, if by asking me, who are you, you were referring to the material body, then I must point out that all material bodies are constituted of five elements, namely earth, water, fire, air, and ether. Thus, you should have asked, who are you five? So next time someone asks, who are you, you can tell them, you should have asked, who are you five? They really think you're crazy. Some Indian family, who are you? Oh, you should have asked, who are you five? Earth, water, fire, air, and ether. I'm not this body, you know. Who? Thus, okay, if you consider all the material bodies are ultimately one, being constituted essentially of the same elements, and your question is still meaningless since there would be no deep purpose in distinguishing one body from another. So if you ask everyone in this room, who are you? And if the answer is this body, then the question is meaningless because it's all the same. It's just a body. It's just earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And it's a meaningless question because everybody was going to give the same answer. Either way, if you say, who are you, and you're referring to the Yeah, the jiva, you know, okay, I'm a jiva. Okay, you're a jiva. So what's the difference? And then if you ask, so who are you referring to the body? Okay, earth, water, fire, air, and ether. We all have the same answer. So then the question is meaningless. You can't tell the difference between one and the other. So that's why he's saying. You're speaking, it appears, in asking my identity, you're merely speaking words without any real meaning or purpose. Oh, very heavy. Words, who are you? No meaning in that word. No purpose in that question. So, yes, Satyaraj says, Krishna is testing the sages, hoping to bring them further by thinking deeply about their initial question. So don't ever ask this question to Krishna or a guru. Paragraph 1 of the purport. Shri Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains this verse as follows. In the previous verse, Lord Krishna demonstrated, if the sages accepted the impersonal philosophy that all living beings are ultimately one in all respects, their question, who are you, was meaningless, since there would be no philosophical basis to distinguish one manifestation of spirit soul from another. So the answer is the same for everyone in this room. It's all one. We're all one. In this verse, the Lord refutes the false identification with the material body composed of five elements. If the sages accepted the body as a self, then their question was meaningless, since they would have to ask, who are you five? If the sages replied, although the body is composed basically of five elements, and these elements combine and thus form one unique substance, then the Lord has already replied by the words, samanishu chavastuta. The bodies of human beings, demigods, animals, etc., are all composed of the same five elements and are essentially the same. Therefore, the question, who are you, is ultimately meaningless. Thus, if one accepts either the theory that all living entities are ultimately the same or the theory that all living entities are ultimately non-different from their material bodies, in both cases, the question of the sages is meaningless. So remember knowledge in the mode of goodness in Bhagavad Gita. What is knowledge in the mode of goodness? See everything one. And knowledge in the mode of passion is? See different bodies. So this is knowledge in the modes. He's explaining knowledge in the modes. What is knowledge in the mode of goodness is to see the one undivided. So, knowledge in the mode of passion is to see the bodies. Different bodies. And what's knowledge in the mode of ignorance?
Nothing, focusing on one thing, thinking that some significant thing is everything that needs to be known.
Okay, yes, very, yes. Okay, last paragraph of this purport. Srila Madhvacharya points out in this regard, the question of the sages was not appropriate, since they had already seen their father, Lord Brahma, worshipping the lotus feet of Lord Hamsa. Since their spiritual master and father was worshipping Lord Hamsa, they should have immediately understood the Lord's position, and their question is thus meaningless. So here is another point. Why should they ask, who are you? Because they saw Brahma worshipping Hamsa, so obviously it's the Supreme Lord, Supreme Personality of Godhead. But still they asked the question, who are you? And so they got smashed by the Lord. So we'll stop here. Any questions or comments before we go for our break? Hari Prush.
It says in the beginning that you conquer passion and ignorance by sattva.
Yes.
So does it mean that ignorance should be conquered also by sattva, or can one conquer ignorance first by rajas and then rajas by sattva?
Question is, it says that we conquer passion in the beginning, passion and ignorance by sattva. But isn't it also possible that we should conquer ignorance by passion and passion by goodness? So that's your question. So it was said in the verses is that knowledge in the mode of goodness will conquer both of the lower modes. They're always put together. And never have I seen anywhere that you can you're supposed to cultivate passion to conquer ignorance. I've never seen that anywhere. So you can try it.
It's just karmakanda.
Okay, karmakanda. All right. Karmakanda. Okay, that's a good reason. You cultivate karmakanda, so that's cultivating passion to defeat ignorance. But it's not just passion. There is knowledge. There's also, it's mixed with goodness, because you're getting the medicine in there. It's not simply passion. You're getting the medicine of worshiping the Supreme Lord. You're getting a little goodness. The goodness is there also. Without goodness, you can't do karmakanda. And without Krishna, without worshiping, without bhakti, you can't do karmakanda or jnanakanda. So I would say they're both defeated by goodness. And not that we don't need to go. I mean, otherwise, then we'd all have to go and do karmakanda first. If it was working, but it's not working that way. That's why we just simply go to bhakti. And even ignorance can be used in bhakti. Even the person in the mode of ignorance can become a devotee. But then he has to add the bhakti. He has to add the... He can still do his not all the activities, but whatever, I mean, his mode is, then he can do that. He can be the python. Just python man. And just not endeavor if he doesn't want to work. I mean, it worked for my husband. He had that philosophy, I won't work. And he became a devotee and he kept it, you know, because it's not work. It's so he kept that mode of ignorance philosophy. And it worked in devotional service because you're not working. Yes?
Krishna
incited Arjuna to fight. Right. Yes. Yeah, Krishna incited Arjuna to fight, which is in the mode of passion, kshatriya. Kshatriya is in passion. No, but the point is this, whatever mode you are in, so Arjuna was in passion, he was a kshatriya, and he was saying, no, I should just renounce and be in goodness. And Krishna said, no, you use your mode, what mode you're in for Krishna. So you've been given this position in the material world, so therefore you use that for Krishna. If your mentality is naturally renounced and detached, you can use that in the service of Krishna. You can be naishtika brahmachari. And if your disposition is naturally to be a family person, you can use that. So it's not like, what can repression accomplish? Krishna says, we should follow our mode. If we're in the mode of ignorance, okay. Then we follow, but it's still at the same time, then we add the devotional service. We add the bhakti. So as far as I understand from Srila Prabhupada, it doesn't matter what mode you're in. You can go to goodness. You don't have to go through passion to go to goodness. He didn't encourage us to do that. If somebody is in the mode of ignorance, and that was an example of this person. I told the story maybe last year, a year before, in France. Prabhupada was on a morning walk, and this person jumped out of the bushes and went for Prabhupada's feet. And the devotees took him and threw him back in the bushes. But then when this was in France, yeah, and then Prabhupada came back to the temple, that person was waiting for Prabhupada, and he dived and he got Prabhupada's feet. And he was crying, and Prabhupada was patting him on the head, saying, it's all right. So this person was really in the mode of ignorance. He was so in the mode of ignorance, he couldn't speak. He was so drugged, so much in drugs, he couldn't even speak properly. But they engaged him in cleaning the temple. That was what he could do. That's all he could do in the mode of ignorance. He couldn't speak or anything. But he had a firm faith in Prabhupada. So then, 2 weeks later, they're going on traveling book distribution. They found him in the van. They said, oh, okay, well, you can clean the van. But then he disappeared with some books and came back with the money. And they said, well, what did you say? He just said, Prabhupada saved me, Prabhupada saved me. So here's a person, and this person went on to, you know, start speaking, giving classes. He got initiated, and so he was in the mode of ignorance. And I don't know if you call book distribution passion. I would say it's transcendental. I mean, he was doing transcendental devotional service. So he didn't immediately jump to goodness, but he was in Prabhupada engaged us. I mean, all we had to do was just surrender and have faith in Prabhupada, and he brought us on a very high level of devotional service, just like the gopis. Unconditional surrender is what Prabhupada taught us. Just unconditionally, whatever you're asked, you do, and you don't ask questions, and you just do it, and don't worry if you don't have any qualification, you just you have faith in in Prabhupada, and then and anything can be done. So this is we were brought right to the spiritual level of goodness, and then after a few years, everyone settles down to the level where they're at. I mean, Prabhupada brought us way up to the highest, and then people tend to settle down on the where they're more comfortable level, where they are, in a more comfortable level of devotional service. But anyway, it's not necessary to cultivate passion. But for some people, I would say it might be a good idea. If all you do is just lay around and lament and you're depressed and sleep. Yes, it's hard to... I know youth, some of our youth, who they go through phases like this where, you know, they don't feel like doing anything. And, yes? Yeah, I don't know if he was illiterate, but he lost everything by taking so many drugs. He couldn't speak. He lost, his mind was so, he became so crazy by taking drugs. He probably could read, but he probably forgot how, you know. He was so messed up person, but Prabhupada saved him. Prabhupada didn't see the qualification or disqualification of anyone. But somehow he got some intelligence to go for Prabhupada's feet. I mean, I don't know where he got that from, but somehow in his craziness, he saw Prabhupada's feet, and that saved him.
They're all attractive.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he just understood, okay, this is it. Yes. Well, he follows the Vedas. And in the Vedas, you have to, he performs sacrifice. In any sacrifice, you have to worship Vishnu.
In Vishnu, yeah.
Okay, that's the medicine.
And Brahman.
They worship Vishnu also. They chant Hare Krishna also.
But they do.
No, yeah, they think this will help me go to Brahman. This chanting will help me merge. I worship Vishnu, and when I get liberated, I throw away Vishnu.
Yeah.
There's five: Shiva, Durga, Vishnu, Ganesh, and one more.
Actually, mainly they worship Vishnu.
Mainly Vishnu, yeah, because they feel that this is a step for us to go up to Brahman. So yeah, they chant Hare Krishna. Now it's very popular to chant Hare Krishna.
Vishnu is coming from
Brahman. Yeah, Vishnu is coming from Brahman to help them. Vishnu is a big Brahman, and we are small Brahman. Yeah. Yeah, if they meet a devotee, if they chant sincerely, they can become devotees. But then it's very hard for them to give up this impersonal conditioning. It's very hard to relate to the world. It's hard, that's difficult for them. Outside of bhakti activities, what's the difference between Shuddha Sattva and Sattva? As far as I understand, the difference is bhakti. Outside of bhakti, there is... The Shuddha Sattva is the difference is bhakti, as far as I understand, because it's even impersonal is contaminated. It's not pure. If you read Bhagavatam 10th canto, it says avishuddha buddhaya. It's not pure.
Behavior or mentality, any difference?
Behavior and mentality, yes. They think they are God, so, and we think we are servant of God.
No, even as a devotee, maybe in Sattva.
Oh, in Sattva.
What would be the difference between a devotee in Sattva and Shuddha Sattva?
Okay. So it would be very hard to tell the difference between a devotee in Sattva and Shuddha Sattva, because he also acts naturally in Sattva. So the devotee in Sattva, who is in Sattva, would be more in the level of Nishta. And the devotee in Shuddha Sattva would be on the level of Asakti, all those higher... Asakti, Ruchi, Asakti, Bhava, it would be on the higher levels of devotional service. So Nishta is like the borderline, it's Sattva. It's like, and you're still really, I mean, you're peaceful, but you're still very much striving. You're not, you're, When you're in asakti, it's natural. It just comes. You don't even have to work at it, really. Your mind is your friend in asakti. Your mind naturally goes to kirtan. Your mind naturally goes to Krishna, to those thoughts. But ruchi, before that, then it's you still have to cultivate with your intelligence. You still have to go further. Sattva, yeah, you're peaceful. You have knowledge. You're peaceful. Everything, you have a nice, everything is okay, your environment, everything is, you're satisfied. You're satisfied with what comes of its own accord, and you're satisfied with your life, and you're satisfied. But still you want, to make more progress. You don't have your relationship with Krishna, you don't know what is your service in the spiritual world, you don't know, there's still things you don't know, and you want to know. And experiences you want to have and you don't have. Yeah.
The goodness, the devotees, they enjoy happiness.
Yeah, they're happy. They're very happy. Yeah. Also, another difference that could be there is that on the higher level, one is more concerned for others. Like in goodness, you're very self-satisfied, and you might get complacent and not worry about others. But really, when you the bhakti part is that your concern is more for others than yourself. You have more concern if others are suffering, and you know that it's I would say it's the higher, yeah.
Balance.
Yeah, right. That's right.
What?
It's balance. A perfect balance. That's correct. Sattva is a perfect balance between the modes.
Isn't that there are only two modes, passion and ignorance, whereas sattva is a perfect balance of the two.
Yeah, that's also true. That's also true. Sattva is a balance, and that's why you're happy. You're happy. You're not, but your balance means that you're not controlled by the other two. Mm-hmm. Balance means that you can be balanced. That you are balanced. It's not like ignorance or passion can bring you down. And that's actually in Ayurvedic medicine. I was in that class, and he asked, "What is the one word?" And I said, "Balance." That this is the one word of health. Health means balanced. The doshas are balanced. All the doshas are balanced. So yes, that's another way to look at it. That's really that's a fact. It's balanced.
But balance means that passion and ignorance still is there because the
pure. Yeah, they're there to some extent. They're there to some extent. You still even at nishta, they're still. Actually, it says almost destroyed. Nashta prayesh abadeshu nityam bhagavata seveya. Bhagavata tamashloke bhaktir bhavati tada rajas tamo bhava kama loba dayascheya cheta eta anavidam stitam sattve prasirati. So passion and ignorance are reduced. They're still there, but it's in balance. It's in perspective. It's in balance, and you use them in the mode of goodness. You use passion and ignorance in goodness. Sometimes you need to sleep, okay? Mode of ignorance. Sometimes you need to get angry at somebody if you have a disciple. Okay, mode of passion. Or you need to be active. You need to, go flying here and there. It's a mode of passion. So, but the difference is you're in control of the lower modes. Mode of goodness means you're in control. And that's mode of goodness. Yeah, or Krishna's in control anyway. For the devotee, we're not in control. He's controlling, and we get the result. Yeah. Yeah, they're not influenced. They don't see that, I'm flying here and there, and I'm preaching. They're seeing, Krishna is taking me here, Krishna's taking me there, and I'm just speaking what he wants me to speak. And they don't think, okay, I am controlling passion and ignorance. I am in control. They think Krishna is in control, and he's just I'm following his path, his plan. I'm following his plan, what he wants me to do. And they don't think, okay, now I'm going to control my passion and ignorance, and I'm going to balance the modes. Right? No, wrong. We're going to try later on. And then today, a meditation. It's a verse, actually, one of the verses. Yes. Oh, okay. You're talking about the Mayavadis chanting Hare Krishna. How does the Hare Krishna?
How makes the
end. Oh, she just hides herself.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur says they are just repeating the syllables.
They aren't chanting. Unless there might be a sincere Mayavadi who actually... Yeah, they're not chanting. They're not touching Krishna. So she's protecting Krishna. She's hiding herself. She's not manifesting the potency. Yeah, that's one of the... Yeah, something. Yeah. By process of initiation, you get the mantra. So... And they're not taking... Well, they're taking initiation, but not from a bona fide. Yeah, they're taking from another Mayavadi sannyasi. Yeah. Yeah, they don't get... Yeah, real mantra comes... Sampradaya vihina ye mantras te nishvala mataha, says in the... somewhere, Puranas or... Yeah, Puranas. That if you take the mantra from a sampradaya that's not a sampradaya, without the sampradaya, you cannot get the mantra. It will have no fall, it will have no fruit of the mantra. Yeah, that's in the Puranas somewhere. Sampradaya bihina ye mantaste nishvalamata. Without the proper sampradaya, it will not produce fruit. Easy. Oh yes, yes. How can we chant with meaning? This is the question.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You are not crying. You are not. Hairs are standing on end. So. Okay, we'll stop here. We'll meet at 12:45.